Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And we continue on this week's podcast in our political world with another of our Meet the Candidates segment. Meet the candidates for governor. Meet the candidates for Democratic nominee for governor. And joining me now is the guy that, I don't know, a lot of people think this is the guy to beat. But we'll let you decide. Let's find out what his plans are for the state. J.B. Pritzker, entrepreneur, businessman. And if you've missed one of his commercials on TV, then you don't watch TV because we're learning a lot of them about on television as well. A lot of his background. JB, appreciate your time on the podcast.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Sure. You've done the Politics Tonight show, so people can check you out there as well. But this is a chance for you to kind of put out some plans. Let me just start with a bit about your background. When everybody talks about you, he's the billionaire guy. But you've been running an ad lately, which gives us the softer side of J.B. Pritzker. It's a bit about your mom and your family. Would you take a moment and just fill people in? I don't think you were born a billionaire, so let people know how you got to where you are.
Well, I've been very fortunate, no doubt. My parents have been very successful. They started a motel business that became a successful hotel business. And so I was very fortunate in that regard. But unfortunately, as you're pointing out, my parents both passed away at a relatively young age. And so, you know, that the ad you're referring to had to do with some of the challenges that my mother in particular underwent after my father passed away. You know, she was young, he was young when my father passed away at age 39, and she 10 years later at age 49.
And so obviously you were old enough to have values instilled in you. You talked about some of your mom's battles with substance abuse, that kind of thing. And how did it make you stronger? I mean, how does J.B. Pritzker, how are you today the man you are based on that history?
Well, first, I should say, you know, my mom really was my hero and is my hero. Imagine that she got left with three young children when her husband passed away, when my father passed away. She had to, you know, raise us as a single mom, which, you know, certainly many others do. But she also was suffering from alcoholism. And so the experience of that, you know, in her life, was very difficult, but I saw her fight hard to overcome it. And, you know, this is a disease, alcoholism, so it's not like you're making a choice. You're suffering, and with all the other challenges of having young kids at the same time, you know, we had some challenges, let's say, as we were growing up. But watching my mother fight that fight honestly gave me courage. And showed me, you know, what somebody can do, even when they're, you know, suffering. The idea that, you know, you've got things that you want to accomplish, like raising your kids, doing a good job at that. So there was that. I think, you know, it also gave me some strength to get through pretty hard times. And we were very fortunate, though. I don't want to, you know, make the mistake of suggesting otherwise. My parents had very close friends, and we had relatives who cared for us and helped us out during that time period. But anyway, I feel like the values that my parents instilled in me were really the values that they were raised with, and the things that they believed in. You know, like fighting for economic and social justice. And that's why, even as kids, you know, even as my mom was, you know, was going through her challenges, we were, you know, working at the battered women's shelter and food pantries and engaged at our synagogue. And so those are all things that I carry with me as an adult. So it's probably not surprising, Paul, to you or to the listeners that, you know, during my adult lifetime, I've tried to really carry out those economic and social justice values by helping to build a Holocaust museum, leading that effort, by helping to feed 230,000 kids school breakfast across the state, thousands of kids getting preschool and child care because of the work that I've done, and, you know, building 1871, trying to create jobs in a nonprofit small business incubator. So those are all things that are kind of outgrowths of the values that my parents taught me. But most of all, and the biggest one really is caring for others, making sure that you're doing the right thing, you know, and trying to make the most of your time on earth of helping others.
So let's talk about the economics of the state, JB. You know, a lot of people, listen, Bruce Rauner won last time around and various explanations for it, but one of them certainly was, here was a businessman who could turn the state around financially. Arguably, that really didn't happen. You can argue why it didn't happen. He, you know, had blocks at every road from the democratically controlled legislature. But what assurance can you give the people of Illinois that you can turn this state around? You'll be a Democrat, so people tie you to Madigan, and you're all going to work together, and it means we're going to get higher taxes. So true, not true? How are you going to fix it?
No, let's start with the fact that the reason that this state is in the shape that it's in is that Bruce Rauner has created crisis after crisis. You know, failing to introduce a balanced budget for more than 2 years, failing to work with the Democratic legislature in any way whatsoever. He essentially folded his arms and said, I'll let the state sink before I'll come to the table and work with the Democrats. So that's one of the biggest challenges that the state has faced. Did we have challenges before? Of course we did. But Bruce Rauner has really driven the state off the cliff. With 2 years of no budget, you know, our social service agencies, our safety net has really been blown apart. Our mental health facilities, homeless shelters, home care for seniors, all of those things, child care, have been torn apart, cut significantly. Bruce Rauner was the biggest deficit spender in the history of the state of Illinois, with $600 million of deficit spending every single month while he, you know, stood by during this crisis. So as a Democrat, look, what do I believe? I believe that we've got to come together to solve the state's problems. We've got to work together to overcome the financial challenges. We've got to create jobs and expand educational opportunities as well as health care. And these are all things that are doable, but you've got to be reasonable, rational, go to Springfield with a set of values and a strong set of plans. And I put plans out for universal preschool and child care, which, by the way, saved the state money over time. That's, you know, one of the big things that people should note about the investment in that is that we get a real return on it. Healthcare, I proposed an expansion of healthcare in the state that does not cost the taxpayers. In fact, it's the public option that allows us for middle class families to get a break on their premiums that are going higher and higher, and for people who are striving to get to the middle class to be able to afford health care.
How does that get paid for? I've seen your ads for the public option. How does that get, if it's not costing us anything, how does it get paid for?
Well, remember that we're simply suggesting that people can buy into the state's health care system, and it's a much lower cost. You've taken the profit out of it. So it's a much lower cost than a private health insurance premium would be. And we're, again, asking people to buy into it. But if you're, you know, if you're a middle class family and you're paying a private health insurance premium, you could get almost a 40% break in your health insurance premium cost if you opted for this public option. But again, the state isn't paying for it. It's the individuals who are choosing to go into the state's healthcare system rather than pay the much higher premium on a private health insurance plan.
There are some things the governor, I know no Democrat's going to say anything good about this, about him, but there are some things that are very popular. So let me get your take on it. He thinks that there should be a freeze on property taxes, a cap on property taxes. Do you disagree?
Mm-hmm. I think you cannot talk about a property tax freeze without also talking about a progressive income tax or some way to pay for schools. You can't just property tax freeze and then, you know, and then say, well, you know, to the kids, you know, you're fending for yourself. That's why property taxes are so high in the state. Remember what the problem is in Illinois. We have a flat income tax system. And the state has only paid for about a quarter of the cost of education in the state. That means almost all the rest of it comes from local property taxes. Just by way of comparison, the average state in the United States, the state pays for about half of education, not a quarter, half. And the other half comes from property taxes. So now you understand why Illinois is in this pickle. So I'm for lowering property taxes and instead having a progressive income tax, which taxes income and says we're going to protect the middle class and those striving to get there and ask those who are most able to pay to be the ones who pay the highest rate. And that's the way the federal system works and the way most other states with income taxes are structured.
The governor also supports term limits, redistricting reform. Do you fight either of those?
I believe we ought to have more independently drawn maps in the state. I want for you as a voter and all the voters in the state to have more choices when they get to the ballot box. And the best way to do that is to make those districts more competitive. And if you draw them more compactly, you're more likely to get that outcome. So I'm very much in favor of more competitive legislative elections. And Bruce Rauner's ideas are not new ones, but the most important thing that I favor anyway is a reform that works in favor of the voters.
And what about term limits then?
I'm in favor of legislative leader term limits, but not term limits on legislators. In other words, my philosophy is you should have more choices, not fewer. So when you go to the ballot box, if you like your state legislator or your state senator, you should be able to vote for them again. And if you don't like them, you should vote them out. But we shouldn't tell you that you can't have back the legislator that you think is doing a good job.
Of course, those two things work together.
Leaders, though, I think that there should be a limit on the amount of time that they can serve in leadership posts. And that way you get some rotation of control.
Right. The point I was going to make, John Cullerton on my show has said, we have term limits. They're called elections. But it works hand in hand with redistricting, as you know, because if a district is drawn such that the incumbent can't basically lose, well, then you don't really have term limits.
Well, that's right. And that's why more independently drawn maps would make elections more competitive and would do precisely give the voters more choices. And I like that expression, and I've heard it many times before that, I really do believe that people ought to get, their term limit ability. Your term limit ability is your ability to go vote.
On the social issue, the governor has tried to stay away from social issues as much as he can. I remember when he ran for governor, he was on my show. I couldn't get him to even give a position about anything. But when he took one, it was along the lines of, pro-abortion rights, those kinds of things. HB 40, of course, is what I'm asking for about and related issues. He signed it. Even in the sanctuary state bill, which he said it's not, but he did sign the Trust Act when it comes to it. Do you give the governor points in those decisions?
Well, he's been very inconsistent. Remember that he said he didn't have any social agenda. And then when HB 40 came up, he threatened to veto it. And for months and months, he kowtowed to the right wing in his own party and told them, that he was going to veto it. Then when he realized that that is not a decision that most voters would agree with, he decided to sign it. And so, honestly, it's too little too late. I mean, how can people trust him if he makes promises and then threatens to break them and then changes his mind when he thinks it's bad for him politically? I think you want somebody who's consistent. I have for decades been an advocate for women's health. I have for decades stood up for LGBTQ rights. And I am somebody who is consistently in favor of immigrant rights.
Do you like the lockbox philosophy? And here's what I'm talking about. In the last election, a constitutional amendment passed that basically says Springfield road money has to go to roads. It sounds inviting, but it takes power away from the legislature in a financial or fiscal crisis or emergency to be able to access funds that might be needed for some save the state notion. And yet the way it was sold, don't trust Springfield because they're going to misspend your money. So let's make sure it goes in the right direction. Should we have more or less of those kinds of constitutional protections that money is supposed to go where it goes to?
Well, I understand why voters have voted in favor of lockbox features. As people are less sure or less trusting of their governor or of their government, it's a way for voters to express themselves. But The truth is that, you know, we need to make sure that we are, in fact, we have a government that's being responsible about these things. I happen to think that we need to rethink the entire way that we pay for roads in the state. You know, there are other ways on a per mile basis rather than a gas tax basis is something to consider. I think that there are lots of ways for us to fund the priorities that we have, but the number one thing that we need to be focusing on is a progressive income tax and paying for our schools. If we do not get those things right, there's really nothing else that's going to get appropriately funded that's really a priority. We've got to get a progressive income tax and protect the middle class.
So, JB, if you're elected governor, you would take office sooner than a progressive income tax can make its way into the Constitution, which is what has to happen. So while that may be your vision for the future, how do you resolve the economic stresses on the system until 21 or 22? Because it ain't happening before then.
Well, I don't disagree with you. The process for getting a constitutional amendment on the ballot would take us until 2020. So in the coming 2 years, we've got to resolve several things in the budget. You know, one is you've got to have a governor who actually introduces a balanced budget and tells you how they're going to pay for the priorities. And so having a balanced budget itself, it would be unique. Under Bruce Rauner, he's not introduced one. So don't let anybody be fooled by any commercials or statements that he makes. He never introduced a balanced budget. So you got to start with that, and then you've got to make sure that the needs of paying off the bills that are lingering from Bruce Rauner and his $600 million of deficits every month, that we're looking at all the tax revenue that we can get. I believe that there are proposals, you may have seen them, that allow us to increase exemptions on the middle class and those striving to get there, and to essentially tax the wealthy at a higher rate, even with the flat income tax system. So as a temporary matter, that may be the right way to go in 19 and 20. But again, we've got to fix the system more broadly and for generations by getting rid of the antiquated flat tax. We're one of a very few states now that has a flat tax system, because everybody's come to realize that it's a very regressive, unfair system.
So everything you've been saying, it's all about the progressive tax. And I have to say, you're in accord with your competition in this primary, Chris Kennedy, Daniel Biss. They all say we need that. So as people go to the voting booth, if they're going to vote Democratic and have to pick amongst you, why you over Chris or over Dan?
Well,
or the other candidate. I need to be fair. Or anybody else who's running on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and also to be clear, you know, I am running a campaign about issues and focusing on what it is that I would do for the state, and what I have done, and I think that's the differentiator. You know, I think people should ask, you know, what were the candidates doing when they weren't running for public office to make people's lives better all across the state? And I've done some pretty big things. I mentioned some of them at the top of this podcast. You know, advancing the cause of fighting bigotry, hatred, and intolerance by teaching more than 60,000 kids and thousands of teachers across the state to, you know, to stand up against bigotry. It's by building a museum, leading the creation of 1871, the small business incubator. Now 7,000 jobs have been created and hundreds of companies. Those are all big things to get done. It's one thing to, you know, to tell people what you plan to do in the future, but unless you have a record of getting big things done, given the state of this state, I think you're going to want somebody who actually has a history of doing big things to take on and tackle the challenges that we face.
If you become governor, by the way, would you, I don't know if I've asked you this before, would you take a salary?
Well, I think the challenge is, I think people feel like, you know, the governor that we have now that takes a dollar isn't even worth the dollar that he's being paid.
But aside,
you know, I don't think it's all that important a question to answer. I haven't really thought about it. I think the bigger question, honestly, is what will you actually do to fix the finances of the state and to fix the direction of the state? And those are the things I'm focused on.
You talked about the governor not being willing to work with Democrats. What about you being willing to work with Republicans? I mean, you know, the state is so full of nepotism everywhere you look. Everybody's got their kids and their uncles and their everybody else working for them. What is your reaction to that? You see it in the assessor's office. You see it in different places. What is your reaction to it? And secondly, what would you do to reach across the aisle? Because maybe filling some positions with people that aren't related to you or aren't even in your party might be a good thing for the state.
Well, first of all, I am somebody who has worked with Republicans and Democrats to get real things done. You know, I ran the Illinois Human Rights Commission, which is a bipartisan commission, about half Republicans, half Democrats, and we turned it around together. When I took it over, the Republicans had really driven it into the ground, the prior administration. I came in and made sure that we got people justice more swiftly and more fairly. But I did that with Republicans. And I really believe that it's important for the governor of whatever party to reach across the aisle and listen and work with the other party. Now, look, I've got principles, and they are progressive Democratic principles. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, occasionally the other party has ideas that are worth considering. And I think that dialogue helps when we get to the hard things that need to get done for the state. Look at what happened, by the way, this summer when finally 10 Republican legislators who got sick of the crisis after crisis of Governor Rauner were willing to step across and work with Democrats to finally override the governor's veto of the budget. I mean, it's a good thing for the state that they did that. But boy, I wish that Republicans and Democrats would talk more. We could get an awful lot more done.
Finally, JB, your vision for the state, if you were governor at the end of 4 years, what does Illinois look like?
Well, we've got to start by putting Springfield back on the side of working families. We've got to raise wages in this state and create jobs. Those are things that have not been done under Bruce Rauner. 0.5% job growth last year is nearly none and in the bottom of job growth among the states. We've also got to step up to the priority of paying for our schools and making sure that kids across the state, no matter where they live, whether they live in a poor community or a wealthy community, everybody should get a good education. And then we've got to stand up to Donald Trump and make sure that we're defending against his effort to take away health care from people across Illinois. And that's why I've done more than just stand up to Donald Trump, as I did over the last year and a half, fighting him on the campaign trail when he was running for president and since he won, but also actually introduced Illinois Cares, a health care program that would expand availability of health care to more people across the state, because health care is a right, not a privilege, and I believe we should have universal health care in the state of Illinois as well as across the country.
People that want to check you out can go to jbpritzker.com, right? Fair enough. That's where we want them to do that.
And if there's
anything I missed, I'm sorry I missed it, but I'm hoping that this gave people a good chance to realize what the Pritzker campaign is all about. That's what I'm trying to do with everybody who's running for governor. And, sir, I appreciate your time very much, and good luck on the campaign trail. I'll keep an eye on you.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
All right. Be well. Yeah, we got magic to do on this week's podcast. And I had an opportunity to go visit something I didn't even know existed. I don't even know how long this thing has been around, but it's been a while because other people knew about it. It must have just been me living under a rock. But there is, actually, I do know it's five years, because they just had the 5th-year anniversary. The Magic Parlor. The Magic Parlor, it's at the legendary Palmer House, Hilton downtown. And it's this opportunity to go in, you have dinner at the Palmer House if you want, I suppose, or just have a drink. And then you go up to one of the kind of historic rooms and you watch a magic show. But it's not your, you know, little kid's magic show that might happen. This is like really cool stuff. I also happen to be a fan of Penn & Teller's Fool Us show. Never miss it. Love it. And it turns out that one of the magicians that you see at the Magic Parlor has been on Penn & Teller, which means we can get all sorts of insight on Penn & Teller if he's wishing to share it with us. And joining me now for the podcast is Dennis Watkins, who is starring at the Magic Parlor at the Palmer House. Dennis, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So it is you who I have to ask, because it's not you every week, right? How will that work? If we come on a certain night, how do we know who we're getting?
Well, actually, you only get me.
Oh.
Magic Parlor at the Palmer House Hilton Hotel is my show. So I'm the only performer, and you'll see me there 5 shows a week.
Great. And I know it's Friday nights and Saturday nights. Sorry, I was under the impression that sometimes it might be somebody else, but I'm glad it's not, because what you did is really phenomenal. And I am right, it's been about 5 years now.
Yeah, we started on a New Year's Eve a little over 5 years ago, so we're in our 6th year. Well, I guess our 6th birthday will be New Year's Eve.
Wow. So was this your idea to come up with it? Who created this, and how'd you get involved?
Well, I work with the House Theater of Chicago, who is the producer of The Magic Parlor, and that's a company that I've been working with as a theater artist here in Chicago since 2001, when the company first opened its first play, which incidentally was a magic-themed show about the life of Harry Houdini. And it's, the House Theater of Chicago is a terrific theater company. It produces all original work at the Chopin Theater down in Wicker Park, and the House is the producer of The Magic Parlor. And several years back, the artistic director of the company, Nathan Allen, who's a very dear friend of mine, we went to college together, asked me if I would be willing to do a magic show as sort of a fundraiser for the House. We did a one-off, one-night show at the Chopin Theater. It was really fun. It was successful. We made, you know, a handful of dollars for the theater. And then Nathan says, hey, would you be interested in doing something on sort of an ongoing basis with the company? And we cooked up The Magic Parlor, which at the time happened in the basement venue of the Chopin Theater down in Wicker Park, which is a cool, quirky, late-night bar-type living room-feeling venue.
And that's what this is. We're in kind of a living room, cool, maybe not so quirky, but certainly elegant and a historic kind of environment at the Palmer House. And I assume what happened on the Friday night I was there is what you do each time then, which is you came to greet the folks who are going to come up for the show, and you bring us up there. We all took a seat. There's a bar there. Love the fact that there's a bar there, which means the drunker we are, the more the real the magic looks, perhaps.
That's right.
But I have to tell you, so I didn't know what to expect. Well, I kind of did with you a little bit because I had seen you on Penn & Teller, and we'll talk about that. But I thought, is this going to be one of those which cup is the ball under? And
right.
I've got these magic rings, and I can put them together, and you can't kind of a thing. Tricks I actually had as a kid, so I kind of know how some of that stuff is done. But that's all I know. So that is not what we get. This is close-up magic. You literally work with – I have a feeling at some point during the show you kind of called on pretty much everybody in the audience at some point to help or do something. But you also do a lot of tricks that I guess they would be called mentalist tricks. And that stuff just blows me away. When you could look at somebody the night I was there and let her know that she was thinking of her sister Jennifer and all this kind of stuff, and you were absolutely right on it. I'm like, where's the microphone? What are you doing?
That's right. And I think that's a fun reaction that people have, because it is a show that I call it an intimate evening of classic magic. And so there is a lot of classic magic that you think of when you think of sleight of hand. But there's also a different world of magic that we explore in the show, and that is mind reading and mentalism. And I started working in that vein with the show specifically because I wanted it to be a show where the magic really is about the people in the room, whoever that is on any given night, that they bring the real magic into the show. So what you think of, what you decide to do, your actions, your thoughts, your choices, make the thing that much more magical. And if we can really make it about you and you thinking of your sister or your cousin or you thinking of a number or you deciding how to move the props around and all of that creates something really magical, then it really does create an evening of magic that you get to enjoy because it's your night and it's your mystery and it's your magic.
So, listen, I would never ask you to give away any secrets to anything, but I guess I want to ask this question. If I knew how you did some of the mentalisms, for example, at the beginning of the evening, you have a bunch of us throw numbers out. We throw the numbers out, and I don't want to ruin anything, but let's just say those numbers come back into play. I'll speak like Tenant Teller, speaking in code, so you'll know what I mean. But they kind of come back and play later, almost like a lottery kind of situation. My question is, if you told me how you were doing it, would I go, oh, my God, that is so simple, and it just takes practice, or would I go, what? How easy is it if I really knew what you were doing?
If you really knew what I was doing, throughout the course of the show, you would have moments of both of those reactions. I think there would be certain mysteries in the show that you go, oh, wow, that is insanely simple. And you would have moments in the show where you think, I cannot believe someone would spend that much time learning to do that thing for that 30 seconds worth of entertainment.
Wow. It was such amazing. I do want to take a moment and talk about the Penn & Teller experience. I'm assuming not every magician who feels like going on that show gets on. So obviously there's an audition process. And can you briefly, you do the show, you do the trick that you did on Penn & Teller, you do that in your act.
I certainly do. I wanted to do, when I first started talking to the producers at the show at Penn & Teller Fool Us, my hope was that I would be able to bring a piece of magic onto that show that is representative of what we do at the Magic Parlor in Chicago. For a couple reasons. Number one, Magic Parlor is just my favorite project, and I want to share it with as many people as I possibly can. And number two, it's kind of my favorite kind of magic. And so I wanted to bring something onto that show that was a good picture of the kind of work that I love the most. And that piece entered into the Magic Parlor a little over a year ago. I started doing it in the show. And it's just become one of my favorites because it's a piece of card magic that's elegant and different than, say, pick a card and then I'm going to tell you what it is.
Yeah, briefly, for folks who have not seen the show, don't know what you're talking about, give us the really brief recap of what that trick shows.
You bet. So we take a new deck of cards, and we use a new deck of cards because it's easy, because they're broken up into suit order. And we hand 10 of those, let's say the diamonds, to someone in the audience, and they get to mix up the diamonds while I take a different suit, the clubs, and show them to the audience and put them in order, ace through 10 in a little wine glass. I cover up that little wine glass. I take the ones that someone has shuffled, the diamonds, into a new and different order and place them in a wine glass right next to it with the faces facing the audience. And then I lift the handkerchief that was hanging over the clubs, and whatever card was in front has now changed to match the card that's in front of the newly shuffled packet of diamonds.
And, in fact, the order of all the cards then matches up completely. So how the hell did you do that?
Magic.
So when you – so, okay, let me see what I can get away with. So the decks of cards that you use, are they ordinary decks of cards? Is there anything – if I had brought a deck of cards, could you have done those same tricks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I use ordinary decks of cards. There are a lot of different kinds of tools out there that are available to magicians, and certainly I'm well aware of most of them. My grandfather, I was lucky as a kid who wanted to do magic that my grandfather ran a magic shop for a long time.
And you, by the way, you talk about that in the show, and that is a true story, right? You never know kind of when a magician's giving you the true story or it's just part of the shtick.
Fair enough. It is an absolutely true story. And it's funny because I was actually working an event I guess it was probably about 5 years ago with another magician, and we were walking around doing magic for folks, and at some point in the night, I was telling a group of folks I was working with that my granddad was a magician, and later on, I met up with the other magician who was working. He was like, hey, I tell the people that I work with that my granddad was a magician, but it's totally not true. Is it true that for you? And I was like, yes, it's true. It never occurred to me to make it up, but I think it's a pretty funny thing. But yes, absolutely. My granddad was a wonderful sleight of hand performer. He was never a famous magician by any means, but he was one of the best magicians that I have known, mostly because of his imagination and his belief that the imagination is where magic lives. And he was just a wonderful magician and a wonderful teacher, and he ran a magic shop for a long time, so I got to have a lot of resources in terms of tools and equipment, but also my grandfather's peers at my disposal.
Wow. Probably why I ended up doing nothing. I like my dad used to work for a company that made screws when I was a kid. Yeah, didn't get me excited. So now, do you get people? You must get people. Like, I want to come back and see it again. And I walked out that night. I mean, just you have to get people to come back over and over, I imagine, and trying to still figure out how you do what you do. Does anybody ever figure some of it out?
Oh, you know what? I don't know if they do or not. But we do. We certainly have a lot of guests who come back, which is why I try to work to change up the show fairly frequently so that folks can come back so that they can bring other people and return and get a slightly different experience. Whether or not they figure out the magic is a good question. My hope, certainly, as the performer, is that by the end of the time that we spend together, you're less concerned about how it works and you're able to just sit back, relax, and enjoy the magic of it.
Does everything always work? Do you ever have a night where something, whether it's a mentalist thing or whatever, and it screws up?
Absolutely. But here's the thing. My granddad believed and certainly drilled into me that, listen, if it's possible for something to go wrong in your performance, you can count on the fact that eventually it will. And so one of the things as a kid that was hardest for me to grasp was that I never saw a show, or I never saw my grandfather doing magic when I could tell that he had made a mistake, and he always insisted that he made mistakes all the time. And it turns out that he had a pretty reasonable flow chart of if this happens, then this happens. If this happens, then this happens. And at the end of the day, hopefully, if I make a mistake, the audience just doesn't realize it. They haven't seen the show before, or even if they have, it's not surprising that there's a new mystery or a new bit of magic in the show. So my goal is certainly to maintain and preserve the magic of the show, which means that the audience shouldn't see a mistake even when it happens.
Yeah.
Should see maybe a different miracle than the one I planned.
That's the way I look at live television that I do.
That's right.
See a different miracle. So
that's right.
Were Penn and Teller, were they nice? Did you get to talk to them before or after the show? Nice to you?
They were awesome. The show is really cool, and they try really hard, the producers try really hard to make sure that Penn and Teller don't know who's going to be on the show until you step on stage, because the magic community is pretty small, and they want Penn and Teller to be able to just sit back and watch the magic as objectively as possible. And so I didn't get to meet them afterwards, but I got to chat with them slightly or very briefly after I had done my piece, and they were great. Those two gentlemen are remarkable entertainers. They're great magicians. They're really knowledgeable about magic, and they have a really wonderful mission for that TV show, I think, which is just to help more people see more magic.
Yeah. When you now, when they're talking to other magicians, and you may or may not know them, but and they're sort of using that code language to let them know they knew how it happened, do you follow all the things they say to somebody?
Most of the time I do, yes. I can't quite recall. I think I've watched almost every episode of that show now because I, like you, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I can't recall not understanding their code. I'm grateful that their code is usually pretty sneaky.
I love it. Now, you did not fool them that night.
I did not.
And but it has to be cool. Are you going to go back one day or try to go back and try and fool them? Did you ever think you really would fool them?
You know, I didn't know. You watch that show, and they get such a wide range of magicians and a wide range of magic that sometimes they're fooled and sometimes they're not. It's hard to say when that's going to happen. I would have loved to have fooled them. My goal, of course, was to entertain them and to show
right.
something.
And that you did. And you entertained me as well. By the way, why does Penn have that painted fingernail? Do we know?
You know what? I would have to look it up, but I believe it has something to do with a reminder to him of his mother.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. I thought it had something to do maybe with magic or something.
I don't think so.
But no. It doesn't. Well, Dennis, I got to tell you, I loved the show. At the time that I said I wanted to go, I went, I'll go do this use that. But I'm so glad I did, and I encourage all the listeners to check out the Magic Parlor Chicago at the Palmer House. It's great. Friday and Saturday nights, several shows, but go online and get your tickets. You can go to themagicparlorchicago.com, but parlor is P-A-R-L-O-U-R, like the old Victorian spelling.
That's right.
Or thehousetheater.com, right? That works as well.
That's right. You can access the box office through either of those sites.
And I got to tell you, it's just a show you want to, and you have visitors in town, tourists around. This should be something that tourists are doing at night. Visitors are bringing guests to, and if you just plain live in the city of Chicago or the suburbs, it is. And I have told more people, just take a night, go on, stay downtown if you want. You don't have to, but go on downtown, have some dinner. You don't have to, but go see this show because it was really incredible. You were incredibly impressive, so nice to the audience, so much fun, and I'm going
to
come see it again. I can't wait. And I'll disappear right before your eyes. You won't even know what I did.
Great.
Dennis Watkins is the magician at the Palmer House in the House Theater of Chicago, proudly presenting this incredible show. Don't miss it. The Magic Parlor Chicago.com or the House Theater, by the way, T-R-E. That's the way theater is spelled in the House Theater.com. Love the Brits. Dennis, thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so very much.
All right, you've got some magic to do, so go ahead and do it.
All right, take care.
You too. Ooh, scary music. Very scary. Oh, it's getting not so scary. I'm going to stick with this for just a little bit.
When the crypt doors creak and the tombstones quake, spooks come out for a swing.
Okay, so now, here's why this is cool.
And begin to vocalize.
There we go. We have to let things go. Okay, so here's the thing. It starts off scary, and it's kind of campy and kind of fun, that song, right? Well, so is the show we're just about to talk about. It is called Dracula. It is the Hypocrite's version of Dracula. It's playing over at Mercury Theater Chicago on Southport in the city. Great fun. It'll scare you. But it's also campy, and it's fun. And I actually think that was, like, the best music to open up with. Let's see if my guests agree. Playing the role of Jonathan. That's a character who is in the original Bram Stoker book, by the way. He just gets married there, not quite here. But anyway, we'll worry about that. Maurice Demas is with me. And playing the role of Mina, a very strong character in this version, Aurora Real de Asua. And Maurice, Aurora, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Hey, what's up?
All right, Aurora, am I right or wrong? Was that great music because it was both campy yet scary?
Well, it's actually funny you use that song because that's a very famous Disney Halloween song. It was my favorite when I was like 8 years old.
I knew that.
But yes, I would say it's perfect.
I love it. So again, it is Halloween time, although this show is going to play until November 5th. So you got to see it around Halloween time, even just afterwards. And Maurice, so your character, Jonathan, again, it is a character out of the book. But if people are to say, look, I've seen the old Bela Lugosi movies, or I saw the Christopher Lee movies. I mean, who hasn't seen some version of Dracula? I'm guessing, Maurice, you would say, well, you haven't seen this version yet. And tell me why.
Yeah, this version is. It's, I guess you can call it, like, it's traditional in a sense, but, it breaks a lot of kind of boundaries that we have set. Just like in films and movies nowadays, we're like, oh, this has to happen, and now the guy does this, and now the girl does this. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen in this play. There's, like, a lot you can expect to happen doing a little traditional Halloween show, but we break a lot of traditions throughout the story.
Yeah, what I love, and I don't know, I assume this happens every night, but you sort of get those announcements at the beginning, turn off your cell phone and stuff, and then those announcements sort of abruptly cut off and get replaced by a scream. I know I'm just ruining that for somebody, but it scared the heck out of me, but I thought it was so funny and so fun. That does happen every night, right, Aurora?
It does. You're right.
All right. So, Aurora, I want to come talk to you a little bit about the women in this show because, you know, so much in the news lately about women, and we're not getting into the Harvey Weinstein stuff. I don't mean nothing like that. But my point is, this is a show where characters, female characters, who in the original versions or even various movies made, I have never seen the women as strong as they are in this production of Dracula. And I particularly asked to talk to you because although the other women are strong, man, Mina just knocks him for a loop. You are incredibly strong.
She is. She's a pretty powerful lady. What's actually kind of cool is that in the original novel of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Mina's actually the one who puts all of the information together for the guys who were sleuthing about Dracula. So it came out in like the late Victorian era. She was incredibly intelligent, and Bram Stoker actually gives her a lot of credit. And then I think as the years have gone by, people have taken more to the traditional, like, oh, Dracula's this powerful man and all of these women swoon under him. And what Sean has done with this production is he's kind of gone back to that original thread and said, like, actually, like, let's look at how the women are the ones here who are really making the choices and who are the ones who are actually strong enough to not only confront the menace and the evil that Dracula is, but actually present solutions to deal with him.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm sure you saw Chris Jones's review, and he gives specific mention to your performance, and he talks about your performance of Mina is the most, I'm quoting now, empowered character and who really grabs the material by its fangs and smacks it right back in its own gut down for the count. Pretty strong words from the great Mr. Jones at the Chicago Tribune. Let me ask you, how much of that is you, as a strong performer, bringing it to the role, and how much of that was directed by the director, Sean Graney?
You know, I think it's very much, it's always a collaboration. I think what Sean did is he really inspired us to want to, his text, and he has an incredible sense of fun and truth. And for him, the goofiness of being human lives right up with the drama of it. Like, I just was listening to this thing. It's like his epic and his domestic interests in life are the same. And so he challenges his actors to live in that realm. And I think when you do a Hypocrite's play, you have to live, you have to love the gut of it, and you have to work the gut of it. And so I think he fermented the pot in the best way, you know, like he really kept it going.
I think so. Maurice, I was actually going to ask you if there was a preparation in your role in Sucker Punch at Victory Gardens Theater for this, but that would have just been a play on words with the concepts. But let me ask you, the men in this show, three men, I think, at my count, you're the most normal of all of them, I suppose. I mean, the characters, the male characters in this show, maybe except for you, you could disagree with me, but they tend to be almost a bit goofy, a little more campy than we might expect men to be. So once again, a play on some of the original roles and making them a little more fun this time around.
Yeah, it's definitely like all the men are very kind of played up, and it's all very clear what they all want. It's like, I need this and I need that. And we all definitely kind of live in that playfulness, but also like make sure that it's living in honesty as well, which makes it fun.
Yeah. Hey, Aurora, do you guys like have to take a shower before you leave the theater every night? Because everybody's covered in blood. The place is a mess up there on the stage. We're fine in the audience, but you guys end up with just all over the place. Is that fun every night to do that, or is it just kind of like, oh, here we go again?
It is the most fun. Actually, Maurice and I are always trying to figure out how much blood he can get on my face at the very end of the play.
Yeah, we're still fine-tuning that, but you're pretty good.
Well, you said you've got some time to fine tune it, I guess. But you also have, but even you know, some of the other characters, like Renfield, who's again a female in this show. Mm-hmm. There's a little modern feel to this as well. I mean, just I felt like she was sort of the modern working woman. So this really is kind of a modern version of Dracula, even though it's not set necessarily in modern times.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, and you know, when Dracula came out, it was a pretty modern story too. So
for its time, yeah.
Exactly. I would say that's definitely an element of it.
So, Maurice, and I was, again, I think when you come, you want to be scared, and there are moments of, again, there are screaming. You know, you get all of that stuff in the show, but you get the camp, you get the fun. Would you say it's a show? Do you think, how old do you think a kid ought to be? I mean, I don't know that I bring a 4 or 5-year-old to this thing, but, you know, maybe like young teens? What do you think, Maurice?
I mean, teenagers can definitely see it. I think it may be a little too bloody for the really young ones. Would you agree, Aurora?
I don't know. We had a couple of like 8 or 9-year-old kids in the audience a few nights ago, and they were hands down the best audience members during the whole play. You could hear them whispering.
Yeah, I didn't realize they were that young.
Don't do that. Don't open the door. Look out.
You know what? I'm so glad you asked. I was going to ask that. If you do get younger people in shows like this, you get those moments of, don't open that. Don't, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly,
and so they do that.
Right.
The other thing I have to ask you, and I'll start with Maurice on this. The set is incredible. The set is sort of designed with this sort of depth perspective to it that is almost a necessity because there's a lot of in and out. I mean, look, Dracula, the show itself has lots of special effects that needs, and you, Maurice, actually can have that stuff happen on this stage. I mean, Dracula appears and disappears, and you make that work in a small space.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of like little hidden places in there that we can use and make things a little spooky. Like we know what's going on, but it's always fun to see the audience's reaction to when Dracula pops up and when we disappear and things like that. It's great.
Yeah, and now the night I was there, Dracula was played by the understudy, but who did a great job. But does that impact you? Like, do you care who Dracula is going to be, who any cast member is, or just whoever's playing it is playing it, Aurora?
I think, you know, whoever plays it, and each individual actor brings an incredibly different energy. And for me, the fun thing is like, okay, what about this person is scary and terrifying? And it's so fun to have that new challenge with a different person. And he did such an amazing job with it.
I also think casting is really cool. You've got, I mean, the traditional cast here, Dracula is an African-American. It sort of throws all the, I mean, Hamilton has sort of changed everything, right? It doesn't matter who is what anymore in the casting. It's a matter of who can do a good job in this role. Is there anything intentional to your knowledge, Maurice, about the casting, or just it is what it is?
It is what it is. We have, like, we cast the best actors in these roles, and it's a good show, and a lot of people have worked together before. A lot of people are kind of just meeting. And it's really just like the best people for the job, and it's just really diverse, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, you guys have actually both been in Hypocrite Productions before. I've seen several of them, and you really do great stuff. So it's just very exciting. I want to encourage people to check it out. You only have till November 5th. Not a long time. I'm not thinking it's going to get extended, but don't count on it even if it does. So it's over at the Mercury Theater Chicago, which is a great space. And by the way, I had dinner ahead of time at the Grassroots Restaurant right next door, which is I really enjoyed that. Really good food. It's at 3745 North Southport. That's the theater. They do great stuff there. You know, Walter Stearns is the artistic artistic director there and executive director, and such great stuff. So you don't want to miss Dracula. And I hope you guys have fun with this and are having fun with this. It certainly looks like you are. People can get tickets at mercurytheaterchicago.com. Mercurytheaterchicago.com. Don't miss it. It's fun. It's scary. It's everything you want it to be. And Aurora, Maurice, thank you for your time this afternoon. And I look forward to having everybody come see it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, guys.
Great, thanks for having us.
Have a great run. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And, hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.